All right, well, good morning. Let's just wait a couple minutes for the other people to show up. Okay, so happy Friday, and I guess the exam is next week, midweek, so coming up. What I thought I would do today was look over the same exams that we did before, but this time in more detail. So I just want to look at all those old exams and think more along the lines of taking them. So the same old exams, and I guess there are 8 that we've looked at so far. We'll see how many we get through. And my thought was that since a passing score is 4 good, clean solutions, approximately, idea would be to find the 4 that look most tractable and make sure that everyone is on board with how one would write those up, and then maybe just a few comments about the remaining 2. So choose and analyze 4 of them carefully. And then just a comment on the other 2. Okay, and we can also think about a little bit whether the your preparations have made some of the ones that looked harder seem less challenging, or the other way around. Okay. All right, let's see. Okay. So maybe I'll just bring up the first exam that we looked at and give you a few minutes to remind yourself of what the problems were and think about, again, how you might solve them. Then, as I said, we'll take suggestions for what the first one to look at would be, and then we can go through how to solve that. All right, so let's do that. Okay, so this is the spring 2019 prelim, which is the first one that we looked at last week. As I said, why don't we just spend a couple minutes going through this, and then I'll take suggestions for which are the simplest ones to just get started with, and then we can talk through how those solutions go. Okay, let's see. I'm going to have a chance to look at these again. We have read them before. All right, so in that case, let's just see if anyone has suggestions for what the simplest ones would be, the four that you would want to write up. And then we can talk through one of those solutions. All right, well, alternatively, I guess we can just go through them in order and just see what methods are going to come in and then decide which are the easy ones to get going with. Okay, so two just follows from a theorem. Okay. All right, so that's maybe a good one to get started with. All right, let's see, we need to get to four. So some others that seem straightforward to do next. One, okay, so notice that one has a lot of words to it, right? But most of that's just kind of defining things that you're already familiar with, right? Okay, so six. Which initially we thought was a hard one, actually, if you may recall, is that that this is, I mean, it looks a little like Mori's theorem or some Sobolev thing, but really it's the fundamental theorem of calculus, right? Yeah. Okay, and number one is also straightforward. Okay, then we just need one more that we have a chance at. Maybe three, okay. Right, so three or four. And what kind of problem would three be? What technique seems likely to occur there? Yeah, this is a Fourier problem, right? Right, there are all these convolutions, so that's going to be a hint that it's Fourier, it's in L2, that's another hint, and it's on the torus. So this is a Fourier problem. And maybe four. Okay. All right, so maybe we can talk through some of those. And as long as we're at it, if we're not going to do five, at least what kind of problem is that? Yeah, it's Sobolev, and which theorem is going to follow, what is going to be used? Yeah, it's the GNS theorem. In fact, it's almost a yeah. So a GNS term is going to give you something like a LQ norm on one side and an LP norm of a derivative on the other side, right? So does anyone know what trick is likely to happen so that we end up with two things on the right? That's one way to do it. The other way to get that to turn a bound that just involved one norm to a bound that involved two norms is to end up where you end up with a bound on their product, and then use a Holder theorem, right? So Holder, I would guess that that Holder might come into this to turn it into a pair. Okay, but it's very reasonable to guess that that's the hardest one. Okay, all right, so let's just talk through then the solution so that everyone's happy with the actual solutions to this one. Let's see, so for number two, let me see if I can make this work. It would be nice if I had my other screen, so let me try that. So we're trying to say that we have a that F is dense in CS. So let me try to remember enough of that to put it on the other screen. So so this is number two. S is the product of two intervals, and we want to take F to be the linear span so all that long expression there for F, all that's saying, right, is that we're taking the linear span of the products of elements of C01. Right, and so we want to show F is dense in CS. Okay, so let me switch screens. Okay, so how does this proof go? Yes, this is a Weierstrass problem, a Stone Weierstrass probably. Okay, and what does that term say? What are the hypotheses? Yep, so if S is compact in Hausdorff, which it is in this case, okay, right, and so then we have some set A contained in the continuous functions on S, and what are the hypotheses on A? And then the result. Right, so it's got to be an algebra. Oh, yeah, and someone else already read it. Thank you, Milo. And it separates points and contains constants. Okay, so that's the theorem. We want to use that theorem. And let's see, let me label these 1, 2, and 3 instead of dots so that I can name them. All right, and so are any of these, so which of these are straightforward? So we're going to take F satisfies Oh, you think we can use the polynomial version? This is possible. So the polynomial version, so which version are you thinking of here? Because one polynomial version just involves I as the space S, just the interval. And here we have the most natural S is this is to use this product of two I's. I mean, there is a version that involves two I's and a polynomial. There is that what you're referring to? Yeah, maybe you could elaborate. I agree that it's possible to just use the polynomial version on a single I and then do some extra work to show that this linear span is dense. That's something you could do. Or alternatively, you could apply this more general version and apply it directly. But both of those would work. Does that make sense? But let's finish off this one, and then we can go to your suggestion of trying to just use the polynomial version on just an interval and use that. Okay, so just using this this version here. So are sum of 1, 2, and 3 straightforward for F here? Three is the easiest, yeah, because the constant, sure enough, is there. So three is immediate. Okay. One is actually pretty easy too. Often that's not the easiest, but in this case, it's pretty straightforward because we just multiply them. In fact, in the problem, they wrote out what a linear span of this means, right? It's just linear combinations. And if you multiply two things that are in the linear span, now you're going to have another expansion. So you can directly compute. Okay, and so that leaves two. And is that one difficult? So here's our square, we've got these 2 points. We just want to find a function that differs on those 2 points. So anyone, is this also easy to find such a function? Yes, it is easy, right. And the key is to remember the quantifiers. All we need is for every pair of points. So for all x1, y1, and x2, y2, there exists a function phi and f which differs. But it doesn't have to be the same phi for different pairs of points, right? So we can take a couple of them. Right? Oh yeah, actually, you could use the L2 distance. You could also just take e.g. either phi equals x or phi equals y works. Right, because they're either the x coordinates are different or the y coordinates are different, so you can separate any pair that way. Okay, and then we will be done. So, are there any questions about this? Is this clear to everyone? All right. And now, what about alternatives? Are there so? What, for example, would happen if you only were using the polynomial version on intervals? How much more work would this be? Ah, okay, I see. Yeah, okay. Then you'd be all right. Yeah, that's right. That's very reasonable. Yeah. So that would not be that much more. Yeah, that would be almost the same amount of work. I agree. If you use that version, right? Yeah. If you only use the one on an interval, then it's going to be some more work, right? Is that clear to everyone? Yeah, I agree, Milo, that if you just consider polynomials on the and allow them on arbitrary compact domains in Rn, yeah, then it's a very similar amount of work. But if you only allow it in R, then it's more work, right? Because then you're going to have to find some other set that you know is dense that you can approximate. So you could use, let's say, simple functions are dense. But this would be more work, but still, it's still possible. But it's quite straightforward if you just use this theorem directly, or the version that you had there. Okay. So any other thoughts or comments about this one before we go on to the next problem? Okay, so that would be one all written up, and so then, let's see. All right, so then the next one. People suggested was, let's see, Oh, I read it, but I think it was number four that people looked at next. So number four. So, oh no, sorry, it wasn't number four. No, I apologize. Let's see. So which one was it? So, well, which one should we try next? So so that was, maybe it was number one. Yeah, thank you. So number one. So yes, let's see. Okay, maybe I'll try it on this same screen because it's a lot to write. So on the other one, a little bit of space up there. All right, so okay, so for this number one, how would this one go? Right, so one, you can just expand and use a standard basis, right? So let's see where to go. Right, yeah. So expand in sine and cosine. Okay, so we get getting a standard basis. Okay, is anyone unclear on how one would do that? I always find it easier to just switch it over to exponentials. It's easier. Okay. Okay, so we end up with this two-dimensional vector space V in part A here, all right? And then in part B, we want to build an integral operator. So how do we build an integral operator that satisfies? So what does it, so let's just sort of work through this. So something that satisfies this property, what kind of operator is that going to be? Yes, that's right. This is going to be an orthogonal projection. Remember, one way to think about an orthogonal projection is it's the closest point to your point in the space that you're projecting to. So this is the orthogonal projection. So K is equal to an orthogonal projection. Okay, and what is the space that we're projecting to in this case? It's written right there, right? So it's going to be R space V. Okay, so is that clear? So this is from the this is one of the nice properties of orthogonal projection, is the closest point. So in this case, I guess this would be my point F, and the G would be the one here inside of the vector space V, which is the closest point, is equal to the orthogonal projection. Okay, very good. All right, and now how do we actually write an orthogonal projection? So what we want to do is find a function k, little k, that encodes this orthogonal projection in an integral operator. case I don't know how to do that. Well, let's just try it. So if we're going to write our orthogonal projection PV in some way, right? So what is it going to be? It's a projection 2V, so it's got to be something times sine, which is one of our basis elements, and then something times cosine. Okay, and if I apply this to F, what is that? What's the coefficient in front of the sine of theta going to be? Yeah, it's just the inner product, exactly right. And so the only thing I have to do is fix it so that my things are normalized correctly, right? So I should, I guess, have some constant C, which is involving 2 pi here in front of both of them. And then this will be, yeah, exactly. So, and you've got the right answer. That's exactly the right answer, yes. So let me just finish this sine of x, f of x. Cosine of x, f of x. Yes, and then as you say, what this means is when I do this integral operator here, oops, wrong one, sorry, I circled the wrong thing. When I do this integral operator down here, what we're doing is exactly what you say. We're integrating, we're taking the pairing with the y part and then multiplying it by that. So this can be written exactly as kf if k is equal to precisely what you just said. So this constant times sine of y sine of x plus this same constant times cosine of y cosine of x. So does everyone see that? Because now applying this operator, whoops, that should be little k. Because now applying this operator big K is integrating against that little k, and what it's going to do is it's going to pair with this and then multiply by that, and then it's going to add that to pairing with this and multiplying by that. So we get the right answer. Is that clear? Any questions, comments? Right. So that's that one, all right? It's an orthogonal projection problem. Yeah. And it's also a nice way to think about the way that these integral operators always, this is the way I like to think of these integral operators just in general, is that they're typically not finite sums, but integrals over these pairs where it's a matrix where I'm taking a pairing and then moving that and, you know, and giving it a coefficient. So that's how I think about these. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about number one then? Okay, so again, the keys were to recognize this as a projection operator and then to know how to write that projection operator as an integral operator. Okay. All right, great. So then the next one. I think people suggested 6 next, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so let me just put it on the other board. So we have this u bar, which is the average, and the hint was that that's also equal to u of x naught. You might as well use the hint since it's there. And this is the integral over the interval omega of u of x dx divided by its length, which is 1. And then you want to show that the infinity norm of the difference is bounded by the one norm of the derivative, it's two norms, sorry, of the derivative. Okay, and oops, and let me just put that on the other screen and then we can work out how to get that. Okay, so number six, and so as suggested, it's kind of written in a notation that makes it look like a solver problem, but it's just an integral, all right? Let's see, I believe I have the correct answer here. So I just write the Okay, so you'd write it in terms of a Fourier. Okay, so let's try that one. So here's one answer. Whoops, one answer. Okay, so you're gonna write the Fourier transform of U. So we'll look at the U hat. All right. And remove the zeroth Fourier coefficient. Okay, so and let's see, this is whoops, I never wrote down what omega is. So omega is the interval 0, 1, sorry. Okay, yeah, so we take this. Okay, and then multiply all the other constants by n quality. Which problem are we looking at here? So, okay, let's see. So, did anyone have any other approach to this number six here? Yeah, fundamental theorem. So if we use a fundamental theorem, then how's this going to work? Right. Since this hint says that this U bar is actually the U at some point, right? So then we can just write, as you say, by the fundamental theorem, that the supernorm here of the difference is less than or equal to the integral. Okay, between any A and B of U prime dx. Right. Okay, so that should be less than or equal to the this one norm. And how do I get from a one norm to a two norm? Right. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about this one? So that's another straightforward, quick one. All right. So then if we go back to exam. Okay, so so we dealt with this one here, number one, number two, and number six. And let's see, so then there was some question about whether three or four was more straightforward. And I think the first one that was mentioned was three. So let's look at number three next and see what we get there, okay? So number three says that if so f is equal to some constant a times the characteristic function twice the characteristic function on minus pi over 2 to pi over 2 minus just the constant function 1. So this is some element that we think of as an element of L2 of the torus, and A is real. And we have this odd fact that Fn, which is the n-fold convolution, converges in L2 to G. And the question is to find G. Right, so just reading it because I was typing it. So let me now move it to the other board, and then we can try to work that out. So what approach would you use to this one? And we've already suggested Fourier transform, and so what is the Fourier transform going to give us? Okay, so this one we have to be careful with the Fourier transform. All right. Okay, so we're in L2 of t. So for which spaces is the Fourier transform fairly straightforward to compute? So first of all, I guess this is a Fourier series, right? Because we're going from t to L2. Fourier series. So we have this F hat, which will be in little L2. Okay, so when we take the Fourier transform, what do our conditions turn into? Okay, so first of all, if we take Fn and take the hat, what is that equal to? Yeah, exactly. The convolution turns into powers. So F to the hat to the nth power. Okay, and we want the Fn's to converge in L2. So how is that related to the convergence of the Fn hats? That's right, because this is an isometry. So this is now converges in L2, and since F is a Fourier series form, F is a isometry from L2 of the torus to little L2. Okay, so this must converge in little L2, and of course to G hat, whatever that might be. Okay, and so if I want a function here to converge, oh, and I guess I decided, I don't think I wrote it when I summarized the problem, but I think it said in the problem that G was a non-zero function. Okay, so what requirements do I have then on f in hat, on f hat rather, if I want the nth power to converge in L2? Right, so I have this function on the integers, I have some values, f of 0, f of 1, f of 2, and I take nth powers and it converges. Exactly. So so either they go to zero or they are one. Hence, every f hat. Yeah, n is unfortunate, but let me call it f hat sub k is either equals one or has a norm strictly less than one. Okay, so it goes to zero. So those are the two. So one of those has to hold. Okay, so then what would remain to do? So our function over here, let's see. Looks like this. Oops. And then we multiply it by A. So this goes from A to minus A. Is it clear what remains to be done to finish this problem? Yeah, we just have to compute. So now we compute the Fourier coefficients. Okay, via the integral. Okay, and then we're done, right? Then we just have to find the biggest one and make that one using A. Okay. Okay, and then what is the actual function g going to be? Yeah, we'll transform back. Actually, what's the most likely answer? Probably it's just going to be 1, 1, right? Because probably these are going to have different sizes. And so we'll just end up with one term. All right, so most likely G will just be the largest Fourier coefficient in A. So this will converge to just a single Fourier mode, just a sign. Okay. But in any case, as you say, it could be that two of them are the same height or several of the same magnitude, and then you get a linear combination. Okay, so that's that one. Does that make sense? Is it clear? So, I mean, there's still work. We didn't actually complete the problem. There's still a little bit of work to do that computation, but once you're done, then you just compute, and that's what you'll get. Any thoughts or comments about that one? Clear? Okay, thanks for the yes. All right, very good. All right, so let's look then back to at how we're doing. So I think we're about done now. And we can go home. So let's see. So yeah, so that's four of them. So maybe we can just say briefly what would happen for the other two, but there's no real need to do them. Okay, so any quick thoughts about the last two that we didn't do? So we did these four, so that should be a passing score. Okay, and does anyone disagree that think that one of the two that we didn't do was actually easier than one of the ones we did? Yes. That would be very wise. That would not only speed it up, but it's easy to make mistakes when you do these integrals, and it could be that those mistakes will throw you off. So having a good idea of what the answer ought to be by having memorized the basic ones is handy. Yeah. Other questions or comments about this exam? Okay, so let's look at the next one that we had. So this was the other one that year. Okay, and again, let me just give you a minute or two to remind yourself. We have looked at this one before, but it's been a week and a half, and presumably it looks a little bit different now. And with an eye toward identifying the four easiest ones to do. Okay, maybe just another 30 seconds and then we'll talk to these. Okay, let's see. So what about five? So it's easy if you know what to do, yeah. So this might be, what would be the approach to that one? Yeah, that's a Fourier problem. Okay. Other ones that people think would be good to get started with, or after you do that one. Six, okay. What's the answer? Yes or no? That makes sense. Is there such an isometry for number six? Are we trying to actually build an example or prove that there isn't one? Yeah, exactly. So you can build an isometry. So yes. And as you said, you basically give, that's pretty much the entire proof. So shuffle a a basis of polynomials. Okay. All right. Let's see. What else? So that's two. We need a couple more. Number one. Yeah, and why is that one easy? Right, if you remember the theorem, then it's a pretty much direct application of it. So there's Hilbert Schmidt. So maybe three, so then that would be the last one we would need. And maybe four. Okay. Yeah, okay. yeah, that's reasonable. There's a nice picture for it. Maybe I just like the picture. Let me draw the picture. So one way to draw this picture is to think of it in terms of complex analysis, and then this integral is integrating along this line. The principal value is integrating along the axis, and then stopping at epsilon and minus epsilon. That's the principal value. And then this can be viewed as integrating halfway around the little circle. It's a closed contour. Anyway, that's one way to think about it. But so far it looks like we're skipping that one. So then we just have to decide on three or four. So with three and four, any ideas about what the basic approaches would be to those two? What is four? Heisenberg, right? So you basically just have to remember derivation. I spelled something wrong. That's very plausible. Okay. Yeah. All right, and so that's a good one to know. We did run through it because it was on another exam also. All right. And what's going on with three? Does anyone see that? What this FP is? Yeah, that's right. It looks a little bit like a derivative. Right, so if I were to put it like an FP of x dx, so I put a little dx in here, what's another way to write that? Yeah, that's right. So that's is a d of f of x to the p. Right. So that's kind of the idea to be thinking about for how to get somewhere with that. Okay, well, let's just do what we did before and start running through the ones in order. Let me see, I forget now. So I guess we decided on doing five and then six and then one, and then we had an idea for four and then three. So, all right, so five. So show that f is identically zero. Let me just pop it on the other screen. So, and number five here. So, f is in L2. And we want that the fact that the integral against e to the minus y squared e to the 2xy dy is equal to 0 for all x and r. And we want to show f is 0. All right, so let me just switch screens. So what are we going to do with those exponentials? So there was a thought, so let's just bear in mind what our thought was. This was related to a Fourier transform. Yeah, complete the square, first thing to do, exactly right. So this will be f of y, and then this will be e to the minus x plus y squared, and then there's another e to the x squared there. Okay. And then what can I do with this e to the x squared? Just forget it. Yeah, right. So I just divide. This is nowhere zero. So this condition is the same with or without it. So dividing by it, we get okay, so forget that. Okay, now what? Oh, and I put a sign error, didn't I? Let me correct my sign error. There we go. So what can we write this? Yep, that's a convolution. So this is f convolved with e to the minus x squared. Okay. Okay, and now there was a suggestion that this was a Fourier problem, so are we in a good position now to employ the transform? That's right. In fact, we even know exactly what it is, but in particular, it's never zero. That's the key. So this is then, if we look at the Fourier transform, and this is almost everywhere zero, and this is because the Fourier transform is a isometry. In particular, it doesn't have a kernel. Okay, so if it was zero, then it's still zero. And then we can rewrite this as the Fourier transform of x times pointwise the Fourier transform of e to the minus x squared. And once I employ the Fourier transform, it only makes sense to talk along with everywhere. Okay, and so this has no kernel also. So this is zero. Okay, so that was the justification, right? All right, so this is our rules of Fourier transforms. And as pointed out, so what is that Fourier transform? So after a constant, that one is stationary, right? So this is okay, and then we can go back using that F is this isometry, so we get that F. Is also okay. Is that clear? Thoughts or comments about this one? All right. So that was the one we thought was straightforward. Okay, so we did this one, and let's see, and somehow I don't know how to keep the previous writing up. Okay, so I guess 6 was next, and maybe we can fit that one onto this screen, so there's space there, so let's do 6 next. So, so what exactly has to go into 6 here? So there was a suggestion that we wanted to choose a basis and permute it. What properties does that basis have to have? And how do we, what do we have to say to show that there is such a basis? So let me start by asking. That's right. That's a good start. So that's a good start. So let's start that the polynomials. So 1x, x squared, etc. Polynomials has a dense span. In RL2. Good. All right. And that's a theorem that we can just cite. Very good. Then Gram-Schmidt, right? So now use Gram-Schmidt. To get. Okay. So when we apply Gram-Schmidt, what do we end up with? So I guess we get an orthonormal basis. Phi 0, phi 1, etc. Yeah, exactly. With phi n is contained in the span of the first n things in whatever you started with. In this case, they're just the monomials. Right, but just the first n, I guess, n plus 1 in my normalization. So a degree n polynomial. Okay, does that make sense? So I could have done that with any basis that I started with. any sorry dense set that any set whose span was dense I could that it was ordered, and I could use that to get these polynomials. Right. Okay, so we end up with an orthonormal basis of polynomials. All right, and then I guess we're almost done. So then what? To choose my map, let me call it capital F. Yeah, exactly. That's very reasonable. So F with F of 1 equals phi 1, and F of phi 1, so phi 0 equals phi 1, and F of phi 1 equals phi 0, and otherwise F of phi I equals phi I. Okay, and so then we just have to check it preserves polynomials because they form a basis. And then we have to check that it extends to a isometry. And the extension will be unique, right? Extends uniquely to an isometry, and then check F preserves the space of polynomials. Okay, and is it clear that both of those are straightforward? Okay, very good. So that works. Did anyone have any other thoughts or approaches to this number 6? Okay, all right, so then let's move on. So the next okay, maybe this one fits on the screen too. So this is kind of a short exam in terms of words, so maybe it fits here. So let's see, so we dealt with which ones have we done so far? So we did 5 and we did 6. And I think, let's see, was 1 the next one? This, right. 3 could be easy. I think we listed it as the fourth one, if I remember exactly. Ah, it was a counterexample. Aha, okay, yeah, so that's right. But yeah, okay, so we'll do 3, let's finish off 1 and then go to 3. So so 1, I think, was the next one people suggested previously. So so what's the statement of the theorem? That's relevant here. Yes, so Hilbert Schmidt operators are compact. Okay, and we're supposed to show that something's compact, so we just have to check it's Hilbert Schmidt, and so then we just need a definition. Actually, the definition is pretty much what's written there, right? That's a very fair question. Okay, yeah. So let me just finish the statement and then we can analyze what we would do if we didn't want to cite this. It's exactly what's given there. If there exists a orthonormal basis, and exactly that formula holds. So the sum En squared is bounded. Right. So, in fact, it's just an exact statement of the theorem. It is not the nicest when you have just a statement like that. So the alternative, I guess, would be to try to remember the proof of the this theorem here. And if you have extra time, you might sketch the proof to this. Okay, and does anyone remember how this proof works? Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how the proof goes, in fact. So so use that the compacts are dense in, I'm sorry, the finite ones are dense in the compacts. And as you say, we can use the approximations, which is the projections to the first n elements. So use projections P to the span E1 to En composed with A. And let's call this our approximation A sub n. Right, so these are finite rank because, of course, this is finite dimensional. And then the only thing we have to do is to compute that this converges in norm. Right, so that's the proof. So, yeah, I think I would feel more comfortable when I were if I were sitting this exam to have that sketch of the proof there. Yeah, just because it does seem too simple simply to state the theorem, since that basically is the same as the theorem. Okay, other thoughts or comments about number one? Okay, so that's one. So let's see, so there was just some support. So three and four both got support as the fourth problem. And so there was a suggestion that we move to three. And I guess, okay, so we can do three next. So notice that once again, this is a prove or disprove, just like number six. And of course, the techniques will be rather different if you're trying to prove it than if you're trying to disprove it. Okay, let's see, maybe I'll move it over to the other board. So what is the statement we're trying to prove, by the way? What's another way to say that? that clear? So what is this statement? In terms of norms. Exactly, strongly, yep. So let's contradict that FP converges strongly to F in L1. Okay, so so there was one thought that we could find a contradiction. With the problem like this, of course, there are kind of two prongs, and until you're sure which one it is, you have to kind of try both and see what works. And so, okay. So you're not sure if the counterexample works. Okay, all right. So do other people have thoughts then? So again, there are two things you could be trying to do. You could be trying to think of a counterexample, or you could be trying to prove this. Okay, so let's see. So, are there any thoughts about how one might go about showing that something converges in L1, strongly in L1? Okay, so so try dominant convergence. So what if we could prove that it converged weakly? That's not quite enough, right? What else would we need? And he thought, so let me suggest, so you could also try weak convergence. Okay, and does anyone remember the extra hypothesis that's enough then? Yeah, and the norms converge. Okay, so that would be A and B, and so remember we had this observation. So recall the observation that we did have, right? Which was the understanding of what FP was. So recall FP of x dx was the same as d of f of x to the p, right? So how hard would it be to check part B here, that the whether the norms converge? Obviously, if that fails, then we're done. And if it succeeds, it's one of the steps toward getting the other answer. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So we can compute for B that the one norm of this FP is just this integral of whatever FP is. So this is, you know, it is a F x to the P, and then P x to the P minus 1 dx, which is just the integral of F of x to the P d x to the P. Let me just call that y, because it's right here. So y equals x to the P, yeah, just as you've written. And let's see, that has the advantage that when x is 0, so is y, and when x is 1, so is y, so it's on the same interval as it happens when we change variables. Okay, and I left off an absolute value, didn't I? Here we go. Right, so when you make that observation that it's just f of x to the p dx to the p, then we get that they're actually equal in norm. So B is a yes. Okay, so that's a hint that the answer might be yes. So then what we would have to do is the weak convergence. It should be enough. I'm not quite sure where to find the statement of the theorem in the text, but yes, it should suffice. Yes, thank you. That's right. That's the way to see it. Right. Okay. So that's All right. So where are we? So yeah. So if we believe that theorem, then we've managed to compute B, and so what remains is to compute A. Okay, so actually, is the geometry clear of what's happening here? So we're taking this interval, and we're making a change of coordinates that shifts the mass around, but we're moving the metric with us. So it's a change of coordinates, and then we're taking in the limit as p goes toward one. This change of coordinates is approaching the identity change of coordinates. Okay, so how do we detect whether things converge weakly? So for weak things, of course, you try it against a test function, right? So so choose a test function phi. And where should our test function live? And then, of course, you just have to do the pairing, and now compare. Right. So this will be the integral of f. To this integral of fp. And if we wanted to, we can make our change of variables like we did before. So this would be the integral of f of y, phi of y, dy. Oops. Phi of, sorry, not y. Phi of p, so x to the 1 over p, y to the 1 over p, dy. Sorry. Okay. Try parts. Right, because we have these two different pieces to our thing. Right. Thank you. Yeah, that might be a good way to do it, is to try to get one within epsilon bound of the other one. That's a very good approach. So try to get the pairing of phi with F within epsilon of the pairing of phi with FP. Right, and as you say, the fact that it's a bounded should help with that. Okay, so I don't know, is that enough to sort of clarify how this one goes? And we can go back and look at, there's the other, only other problem that we were going to look at on the original exam. This is the fourth one, but there was some debate whether this or the Heisenberg problem was easier. Okay, so should we... leave that one. Okay, so then if we go back to the exam. Okay, let's see. So, we got a pretty thorough answer to this one. We got a pretty thorough answer to this one. We got a pretty thorough answer to number one. This one, we're getting there, and we need a little bit more work to finish it off. And what about number four? Well, four, of course, is the Heisenberg problem. We actually went through in quite a bit of detail this argument earlier. Did anyone want to say anything more about that, or should I simply cite see the earlier discussion on this one? For Heisenberg problem. Okay, so yeah, so there was a detailed discussion earlier. That's a derivation that's worth knowing. As you see, it's come up on more than one exam, in just completely explicitly in this form, or close. Okay, all right. And did anyone have any comments about the distribution problem? Okay, so we can try that one. So let's see. Let me put it on the other page. All right, so how would people consider approaching this one? Show in the dual space to short functions on R. Okay, so this is in a dual space to a short space. So what's the first thing that one would consider? Right, you can see what both sides, sorry, yeah, it says right there in the chat, see what both sides do to a test function is certainly a good approach. And I think it may be a little messy. Okay, I've got it written down on the other board, let me switch boards. Okay, yeah, so okay, this is number four. So answer. So first of all, of course, as with any of these, the first thing to do is to write down what it means. All right, so what is a PV of 1 over x? So first of all, we're in a dual space to a short space. So what does it mean to say what it is? So it means what does it do to a function? So if I take a PV, so if we have some test function, so phi in the short space, then PV 1 over x applied to this phi, paired with the phi, so do people remember what that is? So we're going to multiply by 1 over x, but then there's a singularity at 0. That's right. So you cut it off at the same distance on both sides, so plus and minus epsilon, and use that as your regularization, right? So it's is the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of the integral from excluding that ball there. So r minus the interval from minus epsilon to epsilon of phi of x over x. Okay, so you just integrate away from the singularity, the same distance on both sides. That's the key there. Right, yeah, several people had it correct. Okay, so that's that one. Let's see. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's right. And the rest of the right-hand side, of course, and delta applied to it is just evaluation of 0. Paired with phi is just a phi of 0. Okay, so now everything is defined, and so then the goal when we rewrite in terms of our test function is to show that the limit as epsilon goes to a 0 of 1 over x plus I epsilon times phi of x dx integrated should be equal to this same integral but this time excluding the unit ball phi of x dx over x plus just x minus I pi phi of 0. Right, like that. All right, let's see. So do anyone have some idea how to go about proving this? Yeah, that's a typical thing to do. So on the left-hand side, you multiply the conjugate. So left-hand side is going to be equal to x minus I. I'll drop the limit for the second. So x minus I epsilon, and then phi of x divided by this x squared plus epsilon squared. Right, so that's very reasonable, and then consider real and imaginary parts separately. Right, so we can just try it. So what do we get? So if we move this over, real part, we have this limit as epsilon goes to a zero of x times phi of x divided by x squared plus epsilon squared, and then we're going to subtract the limit zero of phi of x, I guess, over x dx. Well, I guess so. We want to know whether these are equal, right? So, like so. Right. And so we could try things. So, for example, we could take the difference and put the epsilons together. So consider x over x squared plus epsilon squared minus 1 over x. Phi of x, and let's see, so if I put it a common denominator, so then what I have, so so I guess it's right down minus epsilon squared, and then we have x x squared plus epsilon squared phi of x. Okay, and so then it would be enough to show that that integral is small for large values and also small for small values, right? So now it's going to split into two parts. There's the part where we're integrating over both of them, and then there's this part in the middle where we're integrating over one. So I feel I'm getting a little bit vague here, but is it I think that one can now do this integral, one can now do these approximations. Maybe I should just say exactly what I mean there. So so we get the integral from minus epsilon to epsilon. We just have one of them of this x phi of x over x squared plus epsilon squared plus this integral in the complement of the ball of the this difference here. And you just have to argue that that's going to zero. Okay, so that's the real part, and then there's a computation for the imaginary part. Yes, actually, that's a good point. We're not using the hint, which we probably should be. So take a phi of x to be an approximate identity. Right, so then the estimate that you'd end up with, I guess, is let's see where the imaginary part goes, is that this imaginary part where I take phi to be just one, so that drops out, and we just want to see that we get minus I pi for this integral. Okay, and that looks like an arctangent, so it should be. Okay, so it's some integration. I don't know, I don't actually feel like going through all the details, but I'm happy to do more if people want to see more. But this is the approach. Okay, all right. Let's see. So if there are no further thoughts, maybe we can run through one more exam before the time is up. Okay, so let's try one more. Yeah, so I guess let me just go back to this one just so we can summarize where we ended up. Okay, so I guess we got at least three of them pretty cleanly, and then we got an approximate solution to this one, and this one actually four of them we essentially got pretty cleanly. One of them that we did 2 days ago. Okay, all right. So then we can go to one more exam. So this is a spring of 18, which we again have looked at before. And we don't have a huge amount of time, so let's just spend a minute or two reminding ourselves of what those problems are, and then we can decide which ones to look at and try a few of them. Okay, let's see. Since we only have 20 minutes left, be good to get started and see if we can get through four of these and see if we could have solved this exam also. So Any thoughts about which ones we might want to start with on this exam? Two, all right. Okay, yeah, I agree. That's checking definitions, basically, that's right. So check a definition. All right, and then what else looks tractable here? Number six. Okay, and so, and what kind of problem is that? Let's see what's the method going to be for number six. So we're trying to get a bound on a norm. Yeah, so that's going to be a Young's inequality. And then what else? What other work is going to be involved in actually getting that it's a constant independent of t? Right, we're going to actually have to do an integral compute, or estimate an integral, right. Okay, that's right, so that would be the work there. All right, that's two down, and we'll come back, we'll look at these in more detail, but what else? We need to get to four problems. Number five. Okay, what kind of problem is that? Yeah, it's a Fourier problem. Yeah, we'll take the Fourier transform, and that should do most of our work for us. All right, any others look tractable here? Yeah, one is actually fine. It's long-winded, but it shouldn't be so hard. What theorem is going to be relevant there? Yeah, that's right. Some orthogonality. It's not so different from the problem that we looked at a minute ago, right? Where we built a basis, right? So how do you typically construct a basis? Yeah. So this is likely to be via Gram-Schmidt. Right. Okay, so let's see, 5, 6, 2, 1. All right, so let's just try those. So, that wasn't the order. Sorry, 2 is the one we did first, right? So let's start with 2 and make sure that one is clear. So, okay, yeah, so 3 and 4 are also reasonable, right? Yeah, that's right, actually. Yep. So, in fact, all of them look kind of tractable this time. But let's just do them in the order in which they were suggested and see how far we can get here in the next 15 minutes. So, okay, so for number two, so what is required here? How could I show that the kernel is contained in the sum of the kernels? Okay, so if we have something x is in the kernel of PQ, okay, so that's of course slightly stronger. What we need to do is be able to decompose it into a sum, right? Right, so we could have the kernel of P here, kernel of Q here, kernel of PQ, and if we take our X here, right, it might not be in either one of them, but it's a sum of things that are in the two. Ah, okay, right, yes, it's the plus rather than the union. So that we can just play around a little bit. So how are these various things related? So what's the kernel of orthogonal projection? So recall. So how are the kernel and the image related, for example? Right. So I will complement, right. And what happens if I take the orthogonal complement of a sum? It's going to switch, right? So we'll end up with the intersection right, so this equation that we're trying to show here star is equivalent to saying that the image of PQ perp, that's this kernel, is contained in the image of P perp plus the image of Qperp, or equivalently, the image of PQ contains the image of P intersect the image of Q. Okay, and is this easier to check? So I claim it is. So if at least it's easy. I don't know if it's easier, but check if we have X in the intersection of the images. Well, so the orthogonal projections have the property that if it's in the image, then when you hit it with it, the operator, you just get itself back. So yeah, okay. So yeah, someone's got it here. So then, if I take PQ and act on X, then that's just equal to X, and so X is in the image. Okay, so to me it's easiest if I just kind of play around with the how the kernel and the image are related in an orthogonal projection, right? Because orthogonal projections have this very nice property that the image and the kernel are these orthogonal complements. Okay, so that's the first part. So what about the second part? So actually, does anyone remember if QP is an orthogonal projection, what other facts does that tell us about P and Q? If I have two orthogonal projections and their product is again an orthogonal projection, they commute. That's right. So that's something to remember, and it's something that you can compute. PQ equals QP. Right, and once you compute that, then it's straightforward to figure out what the image of that QP is, and hence what the kernel is, and it's exactly this. Right, so image of P yeah, right, so you could, if you take P to be second, then you know that the image of P contains the image of PQ, and the image of Q contains the image of QP, but these are the same. So we have the opposite containment. Okay, so then they're the same. I don't know. Are people gaining anything from this, or should we go back and look at another problem? I think that this is how this one's done. Okay, let's go look at one more problem then. Or maybe just talk through the rest because we're running out of time. So that's that one. Okay, fairly thorough. One quickly. Okay, let's do that then. So one. Right, so we want to build a basis, let's see. Oh, yeah, question. Is it true? So yes or no? So first of all, what's the answer? Yes or no for this one? Yes, okay, right. Uh-huh. And how would you prove that the answer is yes? Which theorem is this? Weierstrass, correct. Okay, does everyone see that? We're taking the even polynomials. We're taking A, our algebra, to be the even degree polynomials. Of course, if you multiply two even degree polynomials, you get another one. So it's and if you add them, you get another. So it's an algebra, and it contains the identity. One is an even degree polynomial. So it's an algebra, contains one. Okay, and then the key is the separating points. So how do I see that it separates points? Right, I just need to choose some polynomial that's different at all the points between 0 and 1, and just x squared works. Yeah, exactly, precisely as you say, x squared is sufficient. Notice that this would have failed if our interval had been minus 1 to 1, and it is false for minus 1 to 1, right, because you only get even things, so you miss half your space. Okay, very good. How do we construct a basis? Of even degree polynomials. Same as before, right? So we're going to start with a spanning set. So use the spanning set. You can choose your favorite, but there's an obvious choice. Just, you know, 1, x squared, etc. And use Gram-Schmidt. To get phi sub n a degree 2n polynomial. Okay, does that make sense? Josh, any was that sufficient information about the one? Good, very good. All right, let's see. So we're almost out of time, but were there any comments about any of the others? Let's see. So this one we talked about to some length, and one we talked about at some length. There were a couple comments about some of the others. Maybe we can just very briefly. So this one. So what is? How, does anyone see what three is going to involve? Exactly. You're basically going to go through the actual, the usual computation that this is true for regular functions, except everything involved inside is an operator, and you just have to kind of be careful that every step you make makes sense in the ring of operators. That's really what is going on. So it's not terribly hard, but you just have to be careful that everything works in operators. So work in operators. Okay, let's see. Number four, bounded operator, this is eigenvectors. How do I show that a spectrum is exactly some set? Well, I mean, obviously we get that set because we've got eigenvalues. How do I show I don't have anything else in a spectrum typically? What's the method? Yes, and once I know something about, well, okay, radius will give me something, but how do I get just a typical point out here? So I have my spectrum, and I want to say that lambda here is not in the spectrum. It might be inside of the radius, but it's not in the spectrum. How do I get something to be not in a spectrum? I find the inverse, right? And there's really only one way to find inverses here that you use over and over, and that's the Neumann series to find the inverse. So you use the Neumann series. For the inverse, to show that that there's no more spectrum. And that works. Okay, and that came up in some of the other problems too. That's a good technique to remember. All right, let's see. Five. This is it's so five, as we said, it's a Fourier. It's not that different from the earlier Fourier problem that we did, which was again a Fourier series. You make the Fourier transform, translate your condition here, and see what it's telling you. And what it's telling you, of course, is that you're going to get a function which is supported just at zero, which is the same as the Fourier transform just supported at zero, which means that the original function is just a constant. Okay. And what's the word essential doing again? That's right. We're in L2. It doesn't even make sense to say anything stronger than essential. That's right. That's all it means. Okay, and let's see. So for the last one, I guess we talked through this one already. This is going to be, as suggested, a Young plus an integral, right? And then you'll get some dependence of when you do this integral over R3 on t, and you just hope that the powers work out. And if they don't, you probably made an error in your computation, and you should check that over. Okay, and I guess we are out of time. Any other comments or thoughts? All right, very good. Well, enjoy the weekend and good luck on the exam next week. Oh, by the way, actually, one show of hands. How many people are actually planning to take the exam next week? Is everyone here going to take it? Just show your hand or green or comment or something. Yeah, okay, everyone's taking it. All right. Very good. Well, I imagine then you'll be studying over the weekend. So enjoy that and good luck on the exam.